Welcome to the Dermalorian podcast from the Dermatology Education Foundation. When it comes to treating eczema, those who provide dermatology care know that optimal patient experiences depend on more than just choosing the right primary treatment. As dermatologist Dr. Adam Friedman explains, there are many opportunities to improve the experience of patients with eczema. Dr. Friedman, professor and chair of dermatology and residency program director in the Department of Dermatology at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, described four easy ways to improve the patient experience at the Derm 2022 conference. We listen in as he shares his tips with the audience.
I do encourage you to try to spend a lot of time with these patients, whether it be with the patient or the patient and their family, because it will save you time on the back end, but also these are lifelong patients. If you do them right, they will stick with you. They will send their friends and family to you. So even from a business perspective, it's really important and it's a really good idea to invest in that time. So first and foremost is education. We'll go into that. There's so many things you need to educate these patients about. This is a little different, I think, from psoriasis nowadays, because I think psoriasis patients, having been kind of biologic exposed, whether they're on it or not, but just exposed to that world, or even small molecule inhibitors, they've heard it all. A lot of them know about psoriasis. Maybe they don't have a complete definition, but I think it's very different for atopic derm, where even a lot of our adult patients who develop it for the first time as an adult, they're like, I can't have eczema. That's just for kids. So there's a lot of opportunity to fill in gaps here, and I would absolutely recommend using various tools such as handouts to make that discussion easier, as well as to have it be long-lasting, in the sense that about maybe 20% of what you're going to say in that 45 minutes potentially will stay in here versus the rest will literally drip out the other side. So giving them a plethora of homework to read at home will also limit the number of callbacks you get. Expectations is a big one. We'll get into that with respect to especially topicals in terms of what can you expect from a treatment, and then knowing full well what the expectation is, that will improve adherence, but also what expectations can you have for what comes after? In terms of, for example, if you treat something, will that skin look normal after you're done? Depending on scenario, possibly not. And so making sure a patient understands what that's going to look like is really going to improve the likelihood that they're going to stick with whatever you're saying and with you. I like early returns for especially the new moderate severe atopic dermatitis patient. I know it's hard with our busy schedules, but especially for those AD train wrecks, having them come back in 3 to 4 weeks does a lot of things. One, it tells them you're invested. You know, you want to make sure they're doing better. And I will put a little asterisk on that, is that you can use your EMR to do that and saying, hey, in 2 weeks, send me a message. I want to know how you're doing. That can kind of be on the spectrum of having that early return. But also what it does, and Steve Feldman has shown this, it ensures adherence. Because it's like, you know, going to the dentist that, you know, you space that out once a year, about a couple weeks beforehand, that's when you really start brushing your teeth with great regularity. Don't lie, that's all you do it, including myself. But I think if you have that kind of narrow time frame in terms of when you first see them come back, the likelihood they'll stick with your regimen or will get an appreciation for whether that regimen works or not, certainly will come to light, and then you can kind of revisit and regroup at that next visit. And of course, giving enough of whatever you're giving, we'll get into that as well. So I think we need to really spend some time educating what this is, what it isn't. But I think one of the most important things is explaining how insanely common this is. Atopic dermatitis is the second most common inflammatory skin diseases. It does not discriminate. It affects all age ranges. It's not just for kids, as I discussed. And actually, more recent data shows that of adults who have this, almost a quarter of them get it for the first time as an adult. And so I think those basic facts that you are not alone, this is super common, and because of that, we're learning a lot and doing a lot for it, but also just because you are who you are means that you can or cannot have it, we need to dismiss those myths. I think we also have to talk about the kind of heterogeneity of disease. And now we're kind of moving towards this concept of the AD spectrum. Kind of like with rosacea, how instead of having the distinct pillars of rosacea types, rather it's like essential or important features. AD is even bigger than that because there's so many different morphologies that really come into light depending on various demographics. And so it's all atopic dermatitis. So we really want to be inclusive to not miss some of these elements of that spectrum. We want to educate on what they're doing on a day-to-day. Soaps are niche good for atopic dermatitis. Even the mild soaps are still soaps. And so my mantra is, if you are flaring, no soap, regardless of what soap, to that area. However, you want to talk about why some soaps may be okay when things are stable versus others that can actually cause problems. And simply switching from a basic to a neutral or even a mildly acidic soap can have a tremendous impact on the disease course. And to kind of think about that, let's look at some of those traditional soaps in terms of their pH. Some of them are as high as 10 or 11. You have to remember, the skin's natural pH is somewhere between 5.5 and 6.5. That's acidic. We know that atopics has a shift just at baseline. They're more neutral, which also allows staph to grow more easier. That's why we see more staph colonization. So to throw that in a soap that will push it even further into the basic territory is going to make things worse. So we need to be very purposeful about soap selection. What about bathing? In an ideal world, I would like my patients to just sit in plain water in a bathtub, get nice and pruney, and then grease up afterwards. That's not always feasible. And I would argue it's probably more the exception than the rule. However, we need to also guide them if they're even just simply in the shower. No loofahs, no scrubbing, no rubbing, no peeling. Keep it simple. Soak and smear, minimize soap use. Moisturizers are so central to what we do. Regardless of the severity, if you look at the AD yardstick paper from 2018, no matter how bad they are, what else, you're doing topical systemics, moisturizer, emollient use is part of that process. And you want to have a moisturizer that does it all. You want one that's going to soften the skin, trap water in the skin, a nice occlusive agent. I personally like the silicone derivatives, dimethicone, cyclomethicone, because they're occlusive but not obtrusive. They're not greasy, they're not thick, they're not going to stain everything. And then a humectant to pull that water in. And I've given some examples of ingredients that you and patients can look at on the back that they should look for when identifying a moisturizer. That said, everyone's skin's a little different, let's be honest. So what I like to put on my skin, even if it has all three of these things in there, these three categories, it may not play nice on other skin. And that's where I think samples are very helpful. I give more samples of moisturizers to 80 patients than sampling of anything else, because I want them to try the ones that I think may work for them out. This could also include ones that are meant for eczema under the over-the-counter monograph, FDA monograph, that has colloidal oatmeal, including these things. So I really do take the time to make sure that the products have what they need to have in there. But you want to give them a couple options so they can pick what makes most sense for them. We also want to start early. There's evidence showing that if you have a high-risk infant in a family member or a family that has a lot of AD, this could possibly prevent AD or prevent the severity AD in that kiddo. And we know that just simply putting on a barrier can change the biology of the skin. So there's a lot of evidence behind this if a patient needs to hear it. We also want to educate on comorbidities. This was a patient who's getting light therapy for her AD, and I got pulled in because the nurse said, oh, she got a burn from the UVB. Definitely not a burn. Definitely not a burn. This is eczema herpeticum affecting her eye. This is a medical emergency. So it's important to talk to patients about, because of how their disease works, what it does to the skin, the immune environment, what that can mean in terms of other things like eczema herpeticum. It also highlights how under-treating and not following directions can actually lead to complications such as these. So we know cutaneous infections is increased across the spectrum of all types of AD and all types of infections, viruses, fungal infections, bacterial infections. So that highlights why it's so important to stick to the regimen to limit these specific comorbidities. And since I bring out eczema herpeticum, I do in the handouts have the dosing regimen. I personally prefer valacyclovir, a little easier to dose versus like the 20 times a day for acyclovir. And there are going to be patients that who will need to be on suppressive therapy because it keeps happening and happening. And that's a lower dose of 500 milligrams of valacyclovir a day. And that can make a very big difference in terms of preventing infection. So you cannot ignore the comorbidities, just like psoriasis, just like hidradenitis, just like so many inflammatory diseases. There are a plethora of comorbidities, atopic dermatitis, which then once again argues that treating this correctly could possibly mitigate or even prevent them.
You're listening to the Dermalorian podcast from the Dermatology Education Foundation. Coming up, Dr. Friedman talks about quality of life in eczema and shares effective strategies for the dreaded symptom of itch. But first, we bring you this Dermalorian clinical clip in which dermatologist Dr. Sunil Chilakuri of Refresh Dermatology in Houston offers insights on the management of post-inflammatory erythema.
If you don't have any device and you're talking about what else we can do, you can do a modified Jesner's peel, and that actually improves the overall skin barrier. You can do one pass at the beginning. That'll improve the barrier. And there's a couple of different companies that are out there that have topical vitamin B3, so it's niacinamide. Niacinamide is an anti-inflammatory. If you use niacinamide combined with something called silymarin, S-Y-L-M-A-R-I-N, something like that, that combination actually calms down the red and makes a pretty significant change. And of course, if you have samples of what is Merveso, Rofaid.
Listen for more clinical clips in future editions of the Dermalorian podcast. Now, back to Dr. Friedman and his tips to improve the care of patients with eczema.
We also want to acknowledge the impact on quality of life. This is an opportunity to engage the patient and really partner with them to say, I get it. I know how this could affect your life. And obviously, it's going to be a very wide spectrum depending on age, what the patient's doing, their job, their social life. But just acknowledging how impactful this can be, that you know this, the patient very often feels ununderstood. They don't feel like anyone gets what they're going through. Not that we do if we don't have their condition, but at least we have an understanding based on the data and our own experiences. So just acknowledging, like, this must be really hard for you. Are you sleeping? You're not. That must be, I love sleep. That must be horrible. Just kind of saying those things will get the patient better on board with your management strategy. So let's talk about some topical therapy tools to maintain that adherence. So we got to talk about clearance and maintenance. And one of the biggest mistakes I think that's made is a topical is given, the patient's told to use it for 2 to 3 weeks, they get better, and then they stop. And surprise, surprise, it comes back because this is a chronic disease. And so the patient's thinking like, that topical didn't work. It failed. No, it didn't fail. It did what it was supposed to do. They just didn't understand what the next steps were. So you want to talk about clearance, and then you want to talk about maintenance, whether it be with reduced dosing of a topical steroid, whether it be proactive, you know, preventive therapy with a non-steroidal, which we now have three different classes of, which is absolutely amazing, two of which are relatively recent in the last, you know, decade or two. So I think that there are options to not just get rid of, but keep away. And that's the mentality we need to really think about. What about this patient that we hear from all the time? I've tried everything. It doesn't work. Nothing works. Always ask these three questions. What did you use and for how long did you use it? How much of it did you use? And did you stop and just give up hope thereafter? Because I think that, you know, there's so many ways to optimize that if the person before you did not go over these basic things in terms of how to use it, for how long to use it, when to start again, or what maintenance dosing, that may be the trick to get this under control. And so when I think about potency, I tell patients, I want to hit them hard. You know, because I think when we think about the side effects of, for example, topical steroids, skin thinning, atrophy, that comes with time, not with potency. So if we hit them hard with something stronger and get them to clearance faster, the likelihood of side effects is actually less. So we want to put that fire out quickly. We don't want to let it go on and on. So I say go strong or go home. We also know that's safe to do that, that you really have to go against the ISI and the directions in that giant thing you fold out from the box to really cause systemic problems. And this really nice study from Tino Patani's group showed that patients would need to use more than 50 grams of an ultra-potent topical steroid to then result in maybe adrenal suppression insufficiency or systemic absorption. So patients would really have to be abusing to really cause problems. But along those lines, I know we're scared of that. I know we hear about, you know, systemic absorptions. Patients are scared of that. And so we give smaller bottles and smaller tubes. And that's part of the adherence issue. Because you give a little tube for a BSA of 50, they burn through that in 2 days. Guess what? The medication didn't work. Because they went through it, they used it, and it didn't work. So we need to make sure that we're giving topical steroids in the amount that is needed and thinking about what steroids come in larger tubes or even jar sizes. And so in the handout, we don't need to go through this ad nauseum. There are various ways to think about how much you need based on body surface area and for duration of treatment. And there's the fingertip unit, BSA, lots of things you can think about. The other thing in terms of adherence is telling someone to apply something twice a day, very easy to say, rolls off the tongue. It's another thing to do. And you have to think about this. You're putting something on twice a day. Is that going to play nice with the clothing? Is it going to be apparent? Is it a hot 95 degree pure humidity day where an ointment's going to feel absolutely awful? So there are some simple things you can think about. And a lot of this twice a day dosing is not because you need to do it. It's because that's what the clinical trials did. They were just banking, like, oh, we should just do twice a day. Why not? Sounds like a good idea. And so a lot of, there have been studies since, you know, the kind of question was raised, do you actually have to do twice a day? Meta-analyses, Cochrane reviews that show once a day is probably equivalent. And so I bring that with patients, like, you can use this once a day. You don't have to do twice a day, and that might make it a little easier as well. Just some updates on safety and conversation on safety. You know, obviously, the calcineurin inhibitors have that black box warning that we've been kind of mocking for years now. But we have data showing that there are no post-marketing cases of lymphoma from patients who applied it to their skin. Can't say anything about eating it, but I hope patients are not eating it. So I think we can breathe a sigh of relief. You know, I think also with safety, especially with some of the newer agents like topical JAK inhibitors, there's a lot of scary stuff in the ISI, not specific to topical, but it's a class labeling. So I think just be prepared to talk to patients about the safety issues, even if they aren't issues, because you don't want them to gain that information from someone else. You don't want it getting it from the pharmacist. You don't want them getting it from online or Dr. Google or even from the product insert. So I always say get ahead of it, create a script to keep it short and sweet, but get to the point of what the true safety issues are, if there are any. Now, before you go to systemics, kind of as I was alluding to before, make sure the patient has actually been optimized on topicals. That's where those questions can be so helpful, because maybe they're just not doing it right. Maybe they weren't guided appropriately. You know, get maintenance therapy with a non-steroidal or infrequent dosing of steroids on board. Also make sure you have the right diagnosis before you start throwing systemics at them that could actually make that other diagnosis worse. So along the lines, a practical tip from the access world. So PAs are the bane of our existences. These hurdles put before us to get patients medications. And so documentation is so huge when it really comes to this. So first and foremost, make sure you're documenting it's the right condition. And insurances want to know that an expert is making that assessment. And we are the experts, right? But make sure you're documenting in a way that shows that you know what you're talking about. Make sure you're documenting body surface area, the severity of disease, and also what patients have failed in the past. Now, we don't have validated clinical tools to really document this. That's where your, your lexicon, your verbose, description of the case is going to be so important. Or you can use some of those research tools. Now, atopic dermatitis, as I mentioned, is heterogeneous in its presentation, comes in a lot of different flavors, and so it can be difficult sometimes to make that diagnosis. Another practical tip with PAs, once again, make sure you document. What have they failed? What is the body surface area? What IGA are they? You know, those are simple things that can then fast track those approvals. Now, I'm going to wrap up with some talks about systemics, but not the systemics you're thinking of. Things to really manage itch, or things that you should not be thinking about to manage itch. And let's start with antihistamines. Yes, these knock people out. They make them drowsy, can help with sleeping. But histamine is not the problem with itch and AD. So the problem here is patients sleep, but they scratch in their sleep. Now, you can say, well, that's fine. They still get some sleep. Is there any harm to this? The answer is yes. You know, these drugs are not necessarily benign. They have anticholinergic effects, and there may be some association of inappropriate use and the development of ADD and ADHD in kids and dementia because of anticholinergic effects in adults. And there's data showing that these are used and abused even though they don't really work. So just say no. Now, how fair is that to me? Say, hey, don't use antihistamines, suck it up and deal with pruritus. Well, I got a lot of tools and toys for you to play with. Obviously, those in bold, the anti-inflammatories, will address itch from the anti-inflammatory perspective, but we have a lot of drugs that can interfere with the propagation of itch signals. So I think there's a lot on the horizon, a lot we already have from the kind of true AD anti-inflammatory perspective, but there's some other things you can do as well to get that itch under control yesterday. So I use a lot of gabapentinoids in my practice. We have a gabapentin and pregabalin. Pregabalin's a little more expensive. Both are controlled substances. The way I use it is I slowly go up, but there's a very high ceiling. The max dose per day of gabapentin is 3,600 milligrams. I start patients on 300 and work them up to 900 over a course of several days, and we go from there. The problem with gabapentin is that patients develop tolerance, and that's why you have to dose escalate. The only scenario you have to be really cautious is with renal impairment. They have to go very low dose. But I think it works really well. It works very quickly. So I have a lot of my patients with really resistant itch on gabapentinoids. Bortezomib is another one, and this is interesting. The lower you go, the more sedating it is. So I start patients on 15 milligrams, and then if they're not zonked out, and they want to be, I go lower, or if they are at 15, I go higher. Once a day dosing, I usually have them start on a weekend in case they get knocked out. Does have a black box warning, which I don't buy, but also can really help with itch. Doxepin, I don't use that much of, but I think I've kind of laid out here how to use it. I use it more for urticaria, but it can help with itch as well. It's very potent antihistaminic properties. There are a whole bunch of other SSRIs you can use. Once again, I put the dosing here just for you to play with, but my first line are typically the gabapentinoids. Now, Traxone I do use every so often, opioid modulators, and there are some coming out specific for itch. I start low because of the GI side effects, but also the really funky dreams these patients get. So I usually do a half a pill, 20, you know, I do like 12 and a half, and then kind of work my way up. But I find this usually more effective for cholestatic pruritus or renal pruritus, but I have used it in some patients for itch that doesn't respond to gabapentinoids, for example. So here's some data showing that. Last but not least, in terms of your ease, make sure that you are getting your patients better and documenting it. Because yes, you've done all this to get your drug approved. However, if you're not showing the drug is working, insurance is gonna say, well, why are we spending all this money if it's not working? And then they will pull it back. And there are a lot of ways you can document. Patient is happy, patient is sleeping, all these things. So need to document or else.
Dr. Friedman encourages all prescribers to engage assistants to get drug approvals and recommends the Coalition United for Better Eczema Care as one potential resource. Now, listen in to our Dermalorian Derm Decoded feature, in which clinicians share tools that improve patient care. Here, physician assistant Stephen Hawks of Henderson, Nevada, talks about why he invested in an inexpensive lighted magnifier.
Buy one of these, they're $20 on Amazon, and I've had patients that have told me, you know, like, that is really nice that you look at things. I've had several patients that have told me, you're like the first person that's actually looked at me and touched my skin. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, you know, that's embarrassing, but I've had a few patients tell me that. So get one of these, they're super cheap. It's not a dermatoscope, but it does help you, actually, it helps me at least, to be able to just shine that light on and be able to look a little bit closer, and the patients really appreciate that. And then if you need to look at something a little bit better and, you know, look at the network of a mole, and you pull out your dermatoscope, and then that's another good thing that's been, I think, patients appreciate, and it helps us to really make a better decision on whether we need to do a biopsy.
That's it for this edition of the Dermalorian podcast from the Dermatology Education Foundation. You can get more information on the DEF and tools to support clinical patient care online at dermnppa.org. If you enjoyed the content you heard here, consider joining us at DERM 2023, August 3rd through 6th in Las Vegas.